And welcome back to Curious Medicine. I'm Christy.
Hi, this is Mindy.
We're back. And today we're talking about bedside manner. So, Mindy, what's your experience with bedside manners and doctors?
So, I had a surgeon one time, had the worst bedside manner of all time. I have Crohn's disease. And I had an issue for going on 5 years. I had this one problem that we were conservatively managing. Conservatively managing it did not work anymore, and it came time to have surgery. I had the surgery, and about 2 weeks later, I started having the symptoms again. And I was very upset, and I was having a lot of anxiety and just genuinely upset because it's only been 2 weeks since I had the surgery to fix it. So I go in to see him. Doing the physical exam and the consult, he spent less than 5 minutes with me.
Oh, wow.
I didn't get the chance to talk to him before he came in the room. For those of you that don't know, Crohn's disease is a lot of your issues are anorectal, and this happened to be a colorectal surgeon. So when I was assumed the position on the table, I was very exposed. So I was already in that position when he came in the room. He did his exam.
Oh, wait a second. So had you met him?
Yes, I've met him before.
But apparently, if
he knows you, he don't care to come in and greet you.
Oh, my God.
So I came in specifically because I was having the issues two weeks post-op.
And they had you positioned.
Put me on the table before he came in the room.
For examination, if we want to be discreet.
Yes.
Wow. That is... Okay, so, I did not mean to hijack your story. Go ahead.
He does the exam, starts talking to me, telling me
from behind
results.
You, right?
Right.
Can't
and
see
then,
your face.
And then stops talking and says, okay, well, go ahead and put your clothes back on. And then lets me put my clothes back on and sit down, and then just blatantly says, your surgery failed. I'm going to have you follow up with somebody else in 2 weeks. And I start bawling.
Yeah.
I was already crying going in there. I was already upset, and I just started bawling.
Yeah.
He didn't look at me. He didn't put his hand on my shoulder. He didn't tell me it's going to be okay. That's all you had to do was
say,
we'll figure it out.
Right. Yeah. No reassurance.
Got up and left. And his nurse came back in the room and said, take as much time as you need, and then left.
Oh my God. Okay. When we finish recording, you need to tell me who that is so I'd never go to that person.
So I did go to the physician that referred me to that doctor. And I asked him, do you get this kind of feedback often? And he said, I wouldn't say often. He goes, but what you're saying is not a surprise. Luckily for me, because I have Crohn's disease and because the area that was involved, I got outsourced to a specialist. But not because I had a problem with his bedside manner, because I had a too complicated of a case for a general surgeon to handle.
Wow. Well, I am very sorry that that all happened to you. And maybe we can just cross our fingers and hope that one day he comes to understand and be more empathetic.
Agreed.
With patients.
Agreed.
However, he has to learn that lesson.
Yeah.
So, Mindy, let's talk about bedside manner.
Let's do it.
Physicians' manners, appearance, disposition, and conduct have been vital elements in patient care from the earliest healers until now. There's been this continual ebb and flow of what is considered appropriate bedside manner across time and across cultures. For example, Ayurvedic medicine. God, I wish Brian was here to pronounce this stuff.
I'm sorry. I'm of no help.
I think it's called Ayurvedic medicine. It's one of the oldest holistic healing systems. It was developed over 3,000 years ago in India. They viewed medicine as an art of healing where the physician-patient relationship matters the most and where communication between the two matters above all else. So most importantly, they held in very high regard, highest regard, communication between the patient and the physician. physicians who followed Hippocratic medicine, which we're going to talk about Hippocrates in just a little bit, but those who followed the Hippocratic medicine focused on alleviating patients' fears. Patients' emotions were just as important as physical symptoms. During medieval times, or during the days of medieval medicine, the following notes are taken from my favorite book, Strange Medicine, which I've referred to several times. Okay. Sometimes medieval medicine was sometimes referred to as the Dark Age of Medicine because Western medicine had taken a step backwards, abandoning the science and adopting superstitions and religion in place of treatment. So Henri de Mondeville, which I've also talked about him in prior episodes, he thought that a patient's state of mind was critical to their health, which is not very different than what we saw in our other research. But he had a little bit different approach to patient care. So he told doctors to bring along a violin player or someone to tell jokes.
A jester.
Yeah. So again, we've talked about this in a prior episode, that very suggestion by de Mondeville. But something else that we haven't talked about from him. He suggested to avoid a big argument, the wife is kept out of the room. So these are
I know doctors seeing, who would still request that.
They're seeing, you know, their patients in their homes. So he's like, no, your wife has to stay in the living room. He suggested to trick the patient into thinking things were better than they seem.
My gosh.
Yeah.
And any medical advice that starts with the word trick.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's a bad sign. Okay, so false letters may be written relating the decease of his enemies or those from whose death he expects advantage. So basically, he was like, just tell the patient, you know, to make the patient feel better, just tell him that his enemy died. But like, then what's the plan? Like, once he gets
what's the after better plan when he gets, right. when he gets worse?
Yeah, I mean, and the patient realizes his enemy is alive and well. So crazy. Okay. Another text from this era suggested entering the room with a hilarious countenance, shooting the breeze about dogs, horses, and falcons, and saying, hey there, what do you say? What sort of fun are you having?
Oh my gosh.
Can you imagine your doctor walking in? Well, first of all, I think the subjects of like shoot the breeze about dogs and horses and falcons.
Yeah. This is what a hot topic of discussion.
What if your doctor had walked in when you were having your exam and like, hey, what sort of fun are you having?
Yeah. I'll be honest though, I have had a gynecologist talk to me about the Astros during an exam before.
Yeah, I know. And you're just looking at the ceiling going, oh, can this just hurry up? Would you rather a doctor chat you up during a gynecologic exam? Or would you rather them just be quiet and just get it done?
I don't know. I think I'd kind of enjoy the conversation.
Yeah.
Just to make it less awkward, especially if like certain noises were happening. Like, are we just going to ignore the sound that just made?
I gotcha. Yeah, I awkward silence during a procedure, whether you're the person performing it or the person having it, is awkward.
Unless I was having a lot of pain and it was very visible that
of
I was
course.
Uncomfortable.
Yes.
Then I'm all for, okay, let's just talk about it. Let's distract. Let's get this,
right.
you know, because in my opinion, as a patient, it may go by quicker.
Right.
And it'll be easier.
Right.
To just distract yourself with a little bit of conversation.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's interesting the things they choose to talk about.
Falcons.
Horses. Okay. Yet another writing from this time states, on the way, learn as much as possible from the messenger so that if you discover nothing from the patient's pulse or water, and here I think they mean water, I think that's the same as urine. So okay. that if you discover nothing from the patient's pulse or urine, you may still astonish him. Praise the beauty of the country and the house. or the liberality of the family, do not be in a hurry to give an opinion, for the friends will be more grateful for your judgment if they have to wait for it. In other words, I think that here they're saying establish a rapport. I think that's what they're basically saying.
Yeah.
Do you take it that way?
No.
Oh, how do you take it?
I mean, it kind of sounds like avoid the confrontation.
Oh, I take it as like, on the way, learn as much as possible from the messenger so that if you discover nothing from the patient's pulse or water, you may still astonish
okay,
them.
Okay, you're right. I see what you're saying.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I guess that could go a variety of ways.
But how much information are you going to gain talking about falcons and the house?
No, this is a different person. This is a different writer. Oh. Remember when I said yet another writing from this era? When the medieval times were like hundreds of years. Okay. So, Mindy, now, patients arrive with fear and anxiety when they go to see the doctor in right. some cases. I mean, yeah. some people are very comfortable and whatever, but, you know, there are those times where they arrive with fear and anxiety. It is the doctor's responsibility to calm their fears.
Yes.
As medical technology evolves, essential bedside manners are disappearing, and you're going to touch on that in just a little bit.
Right.
Okay, so, Mindy, let's talk about dress and decorum in the ancient times, because yeah. I am going to continue to talk about ancient times stuff, and then later you're going to talk about the more modern yeah. times. As far back as 1000 BC, a witch doctor set himself apart from the general population, and his clothing and way of life distinguished him. Not only did his embellishments signify distinction and superiority over other members of the group, but they were intended to produce a terrifying aspect which would impress and frighten demons. Because he was a witch doctor, don't forget. You're looking at me like, what?
Yeah.
He's a witch doctor. This is 1000 BC.
Oh, my Lord.
Okay. They didn't have much in the way of, like, good medicine right. to offer. Right. So they just had to.
All demons.
It was all trickery. Yeah. Prayers and chanting and whatever. Okay. Later in time, Hippocrates. Hippocrates came to be the exemplar for physician behavior. Hippocrates believed that physicians should be healthy in body and soul, and be very virtuous. He believed that physicians could influence the moral life of the sick, that the physician's basic duty is to help the sick, and that those who cannot or do not want to help the sick should leave the profession. And I don't disagree with that.
Right. I was going to say facts.
Yes. Hippocrates saw patients with empathy as creatures who are in pain and in need of help. He saw patients as individuals, not as a list of symptoms. The Hippocratic Oath is sort of like a Bill of Rights for patients and established how a physician's attitude should be toward his patient. Hippocrates swore to use his best judgment and care for patients to the best of his ability. He swore to only do that which would benefit the patient. He swore to abstain from any wrongdoing. And he swore to keep the patient's information private. So he was ahead of the curve on this HIPAA stuff.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I thought that was very interesting. The Hippocratic Corpus is a body of work believed to be written by several Greek contributing authors. And the following is a quote from the Hippocratic Corpus. The physician ought also to be confidential, very chaste, sober, not a wine bibber. Not a wine bibber. And he ought to be fastidious in everything, for this is what the profession demands, Mindy. He ought to have an appearance and approach that is distinguished. Everything ought to be in moderation. These things are advantageous, so it is said. Be solicitous in your approach to the patient. Not with the head thrown back arrogantly or hesitantly with lowered glance, but with the head inclined slightly as the art demands. He ought to hold his head humbly and evenly. His hair should not be too much smoothed down, nor his beard curled like that of a degenerate youth.
Curled?
Gravity.
Beard curled?
It says, nor his beard curled like that of a degenerate youth.
Okay.
Maybe long?
Maybe.
Because the longer it gets curlier? Yeah. I don't know. Okay. Gravity signifies breadth of experience. He should approach the patient with moderate steps, not noisily, gazing calmly at the sick bed. He should endure peacefully the insults of the patients, since those suffering from melancholic or frenetic ailments are likely to hurl evil words at physicians. All right.
Have you had anybody hurl evil words at you?
I have had a patient, I'm trying to think of anyone in particular. I have had patients that have had, yes. But I am always like super quick to stop what I'm doing and say, we can stop if you want.
Yeah.
You know, you can scream, right. You can scream all that you want. But if you want me to stop, I need you to say that to me. Like you right. You can say whatever curse word you want. Yeah,
because sometimes that helps alleviate some
of
the pain.
Yes. And I'm not trying to, you know, dictate how they express themselves. But I don't know. I haven't had anybody like call me names.
Yeah.
But I've just had them, you know, scream out in pain. And so it doesn't happen often, but it does happen. And so I just want to make sure, like, you know, do you want me to keep going or do you want me to stop? They're like, you know, almost always they're like, no, keep going. Just let's just go and get it over with. That's usually what they say. Yeah. But I've also had patients that are like, no, stop. Gotta do something else. Okay. Galen. Let's talk about Galen now. Galen came after Hippocrates, and he continued and extended the Hippocratic Oath. Galen thought that an excellent physician is also a philosopher, that an excellent physician rejects wealth and pleasure, and that an excellent physician must be logical, ethical, and a lover of wisdom. Mindy. Galen also, yes.
Now, when you say they should reject wealth, does that mean that they should not be paid for their services?
Oh, well, you know, there's a whole episode on physicians' fees, but it is reported that Galen never asked to be paid. Now, if someone offered to pay him for his medical services, he would accept their payment, but he never asked to be paid.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. That's what I read a long time ago for another episode. Okay, Galen believed that only a doctor is qualified to cure a disease. I guess as opposed to like the barber surgeons of those days or whatever. Yeah. Patients are in a position of inferiority and submission to the doctor. So if you go, Galen thought, if you're a patient and you come to me, I'm the boss of you and you're going to do what I say.
Yeah.
In fact, I've actually seen doctors like that in the current day. We're going to talk about that later.
Did they have second opinions back then?
Oh, yeah, we're going to get to that. Yeah. So Galen also thought, if a patient wants to be cured, he must unconditionally surrender to and follow the advice of the physician. Unconditionally. Again, I say this, you do what I say. Yeah. All right, let's move on to European and then later American societies from the Industrial Revolution. The Industrial Revolution brought about urbanization. Urbanization brought about disease and poverty. But thanks to the Enlightenment, the lower classes were now being treated in hospitals. The 1789 Manchester typhus epidemic in Britain forced the hospital to double the number of staff members which then created internal bickering, if you can imagine.
This is sounding all too familiar.
This internal bickering became so out of hand that the hospital had to close the ward that had been created for the typhus fever. Okay. Let's just imagine, because right now we're living in a time of an epidemic.
Exactly.
I mean, a pandemic. Yeah. Sorry. We're living in a time of a pandemic. So can you imagine that, like, those, okay, let's just pretend, like, those little white tents that they had, you know, like, Cirque du Soleil sets up.
Yep.
Those white tents that they were having in New York and places where, you know, it was just so many COVID cases. Yeah. Can you imagine if the doctors were just so, there was so much bickering amongst them that they were just like, take the tents down, forget it. Like, we surrender, we go home. Because.
And I know that every single person wanted to do that.
Wanted to,
like,
do what?
Almost every healthcare worker. Like, because patients are in a pandemic and freaking out and are mad and angry and yelling. And I bet every single person has just wanted to say, well, screw you then.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Get COVID.
No, but I'm saying bickering amongst the healthcare workers. So, like, the doctors.
Yeah.
There's so much bickering.
Because, like, you're working all the time in the middle of a pandemic. And
yeah. Well.
Together 24/7. And, well, even during a winter storm. If you're locked up, if you're on the code gray team and you're spending the night in the hospital. And
do you want to be the call out team, the write out team, the post write out team? What do you want? I don't want to be on any team.
Yeah.
No, I'm kidding. I'm kidding. Okay. Hospital administrators charged Dr. Thomas Percival with the great task of creating a code of conduct for the hospital physicians. This assignment culminated in Percival's publication of Medical Ethics, which later became the springboard for the American Medical Association's Code of Ethics in 1847. Mindy, I am going to read to you an excerpt from the AMA's Code of Ethics, the very first one from 1847.
Go for it.
Okay. A physician in attendance on a case should avoid expensive complications and tedious ceremonials, as being beneath the dignity of true science and embarrassing to the patient and his family, whose troubles are already great.
Okay. What if, let's take, we're watching an episode of House, for instance, and a patient comes to you with these symptoms. You have no idea what is wrong with them.
Yeah.
And you test this theory, you test this. Sometimes it's a process of elimination if you don't know what's going on. So what, I mean, are they going to get fired if they misdiagnose?
Let me tell you about the duties of physicians to their patients from this Code of Ethics in 1847. Okay. Duties of physicians to their patients. They should study also in their deportment, so to unite tenderness with firmness and condescension with authority, as to inspire the minds of their patients with gratitude, respect, and confidence. So what, you better check yourself before you wreck yourself. That's how I summarize this, okay? So that patients will like you and respect you. Okay. Frequent visits to the sick are in general requisite, since they enable the physician to arrive at a more perfect knowledge of the disease, to meet promptly every change which may occur, and also tend to preserve the confidence of the patient. But unnecessary visits are to be avoided, as they give useless anxiety to the patient, tend to diminish the authority of the physician, and render him liable to be suspected of interested motives. So go and check on your patient and be very attentive, but don't overdo it. don't wear out your welcome, which is what my mom used to say when I would want to go to a friend's house over and over. She'd be like, don't wear out your welcome. Okay. Another another duty of the physician to their patients. A physician should not be forward to make gloomy prognostications because they savor of empiricism by magnifying the importance of his service in the treatment or cure of the disease. But he should not fail, on proper occasions, to give the friends of the patient timely notice of danger when it really occurs, and even to the patient himself, if absolutely necessary. This office, however, is so peculiarly alarming when executed by him, the physician, that it ought to be declined whenever it can be assigned to any other person of sufficient judgment and delicacy. For the physician should be the minister of hope and comfort to the sick, that by such cordials to the drooping spirit, he may smooth the bed of the death, revive expiring life, and counteract the depressing influence of those maladies which often disturb the tranquility of the most resigned in their last moments. The life of the sick person can be shortened not only by the acts, but also by the words or manner of a physician. It is, therefore, a sacred duty to guard himself carefully in this respect and to avoid all things which have a tendency to discourage the patient and depress his spirits. So basically, this paragraph is saying, don't go in there and tell your patient if you are all just doom and gloom about his diagnosis and prognosis. In fact, maybe just tell the patient's family and then let the patient's family tell the patient.
It's outrageous.
I know. And in some cases, they didn't even tell the patient's families.
What year was this?
1847. That is not all. I am going to now shock you with some information about withholding information from patients. I have a whole section on this. Withholding information from patients, as I just described, you know, their diagnosis, their prognosis, the treatment plan.
Everything they should rightfully know.
All of the patient's rights, exactly. All of that stuff was very frequently withheld from patients across time, all the way back to very ancient times. And it's interesting because, as a side note, I was listening to a podcast the other day. I start so many conversations with that. And they were talking about, it was like a current day thing. This person was on this show being interviewed, and she was from an Eastern country. So like China, or I think she was from China. And she was saying that her grandmother is, I don't know, like in her 90s or something. And she has some kind of lung cancer or something. And they decided not to tell her grandmother that she had lung cancer. And so her grandmother is just going throughout her day just thinking that she went and had like a CT or something.
She having symptoms?
She was, but they told her that everything was okay. They totally lied to her. So not only did they withhold her diagnosis, but they lied to her and told her that she was okay. And because she thinks there's nothing wrong with her, she started, like, she got
getting
healthier.
Better.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Anyway. Okay. Withholding information from patients. Hippocrates advised to reveal nothing of the patient's future or present condition. Such honest revelations have caused many patients to take a turn for the worse. Okay.
I mean, that would make sense, but...
Yeah, I mean, okay, Mindy, if you were in that position of having like, okay, let's pretend like we're that girl from China with her grandmother.
Yeah.
If you had a grandmother, it's hard because our culture is so different, but yeah. If you had a grandmother and she got diagnosed with cancer, I mean, would you tell her?
Yes.
Yeah, me too.
Especially because I would want her to plan everything for when she passes. And I think most grandmothers would. They don't want to die without having all their affairs in order. They know their age.
Yeah.
Let me say that.
Yeah.
Right. So they want to be prepared.
Yeah.
And I would never want to hide something like that. And I would want her to, I don't know. How do you explain
that? Well, I can say that.
I can see like, oh, let her live. Ignorance is bliss. But
I can say that I used to work in the pediatric specialty. I used to work in pediatrics. And I knew of one family in particular whose adolescent child had, they had a fatal disease.
Okay.
And the family chose not to tell the adolescent child that he was dying. So every time I interacted with this patient, you know, we would get reminded that, hey, he doesn't know that he has this fatal disease, so you cannot discuss it with him.
Oh, wow.
So I just remember, like, that's the only time that I remember that coming up. And I just remember thinking how bizarre that was.
What was the consensus of the rest of the department? It was, generally speaking, were people for or against that? Or were, because in my head, I'm kind of like,
I don't remember.
I'm not against that, maybe, for a young child. But at the same time, I guess I don't know how I feel about it.
I don't remember ever having a discussion with anybody about it. I just remember feeling like, I just remember feeling conflicted about it.
Yeah.
Like almost like I was participating in something that I didn't know if I wanted to be participating in.
Yeah.
On the other hand, you know, kids with cancer and that's a heavy, I mean, they can't even understand it.
Right.
But also kids are very resilient. So I don't know. Yeah. I don't know. Everybody's different. I guess, you know, everybody's different,
yeah.
But it is a very big conundrum, you know, this idea. Okay. Plato, even though he wasn't a physician, he was, what was he? A philosopher.
Yeah.
Yeah. He believed that the doctor's primary duty was to improve the patient's health. Okay. So if lying to the patient achieved that goal, then so be it. Go ahead. Lie to your patient. That's what he said, the great philosopher. Now, Galen said that doctors have the right to withhold the truth from a patient about the current state of health or nature of the disease, also the treatment, also the prognosis, because, wait for it, once the patient is aware, they may change doctors.
Oh my gosh. Mm-hmm. So if we're That's talking treatments, said. If you're hiding the treat, how can you hide a treatment?
I know, right?
Unless you're giving them a pill.
I guess
that
I guess
say
what
the pill
he
is something
I
else.
Guess what he meant was you have the right to withhold. Maybe what the plan of treatment's going to be. I don't know.
Yeah,
I don't know. Okay, Percival, the one who had to, you know, get the doctors that were bickering at the hospital.
Yeah,
that guy. He said the life of a sick person can be shortened not only by the acts, but also by the words or manner of a physician. It is therefore a sacred duty to avoid all things which have a tendency to discourage the patient and to depress his spirits. So, you know, the AMA code of ethics that I read from earlier, that's where they got their information was from Percival. That's where they got their inspiration. But 20th century physician, this goes into the 20th century. Okay. So in my lifetime, Mindy, 20th century physicians, they tended to favor withholding or disclosing diagnoses and prognoses based on the situation. So sometimes they disclosed the truth and sometimes they didn't.
Based on the patient and how they felt they would react?
I get, yeah, it just, yeah. It depended on the circumstances. So who knows what all they took into account. But they also tended to make a distinction between withholding the truth from the patient and overtly lying to the patient. So I guess if a patient said, do I have cancer? They, you know, yeah. saw that. If they said no, that was very different than just not telling the patient.
Yeah.
So they most often withheld the truth because of the expected unfavorable emotional reaction. So I think that would be a very hard part of a physician's job is to have to give patients that kind of information. And if I were a doctor and I had to do that, I would want to really hone in. And, like, I would really want to sharpen that skill so that I did it
right.
in the most empathetic way.
Agreed.
Yeah.
Same thing, too, with cops.
Or failed,
law enforcement.
Or failed surgeries.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, when law enforcement has to notify family members, yeah. hey, we found
yeah.
your family member. Breaking bad news is
yeah
something that requires empathy, which yeah. we will get into a little bit later.
So the second reason for withholding information from the patient was at the request of the patient's family. Some doctors even went so far as to change the diagnosis and the medical records to avoid any future mention of cancer. What?
Wow.
Yeah, that was like in the 1970s. Doctors admitted to doing this. Also, as late as 1970s, Italian deontology code, which is sort of like the code of ethics, but in Italy, stated a serious or lethal prognosis can be hidden from the patient, but not from the family. So,
yeah. So
you can lie to the patient, but you can't lie to the family.
My goodness.
Which, and this is funny because, you know, I'm almost 50 and I got pregnant when I was in college on accident, and it was an unplanned thing. And I went to the hospital because I was very sick. I didn't know I was pregnant. And they told my mom that I was pregnant before they told me. I mean, I was 21.
But still.
Yeah. But still, it's like, yeah. I mean, can you imagine?
No,
yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Being 21 years old.
But that's just what they did. That's just how it was. And that's not even that long ago.
Wow.
Yeah. There was no respect for me as an individual. Like, I'm an adult, you know, at 21, I'm an adult.
Yeah.
I'm, you know, fully, you know, like I could totally be expected to take care of right. myself, which,
right.
which, you know, in very short order I did because I had to grow up fast. But the point is like, yeah, it's, I mean, that was not so long ago
yeah.
that they were like, yeah, didn't even tell me. So.
Wow.
So Mindy, talk to us about current day bedside manner and.
So current day, I just want to start off with some examples of bedside manner. What we know as now.
Mm-hmm.
The first one being making eye contact with your patient.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll say this, I think a lot of what we do now differs from what was established back in the day.
What do you mean?
None of what I'm going to say encourages physicians to withhold information from right. their patients.
Yeah.
Let me just say that.
So what you're saying is bedside manner has improved?
Has improved. Okay. Significantly. Well, I guess depends on who the judge is.
Well, I think it depends on the bedside manner of the physician. Because right. some have really excellent ones and some don't.
It's very true.
I think it's one of those things where you either have it or you don't.
Agreed.
Yeah.
And I'll get into that too. You know, is training even...
Is Can you teach people exactly, this? Yeah, yeah.
Exactly. Or is it an innate quality?
Yeah.
Something that I love, giving a proper introduction to the patient and the family. You walk into a room, you need to introduce yourself.
I 100% agree. Yeah. I get so annoyed when I go have a mammogram, for example, and the tech does not introduce herself to me. I just want to just say to them, you know, excuse me, but you are about to touch all over my bosom.
Yeah.
You can at least introduce yourself.
Right.
And how people don't just know to do that
right.
is
common
mind
courtesy.
Blowing to
common
me.
Courtesy.
It's yeah. mind blowing.
Agreed. One other big thing too, using vocabulary that the patient can easily understand. When I work with students, this is something that I have to stress to them, because when you're a student and you're in the class and you're using that textbook vocabulary, it's hard to get out of using it. So when you're speaking to patients, you need to, I hate to use the word dumb it down, but you need to dumb it down. You need to use those lay terms that everybody knows. You cannot be using medical terminology in front of a patient.
Right.
Using honest body language. So I think that kind of falls back into like making eye contact. Mm-hmm. Don't have your body turned away from a patient or hunching down in a corner of trying to avoid confrontation or avoid if you do have to deliver bad news.
Mm-hmm.
Don't avoid that.
Yeah.
Another one, listening to the patient carefully with undivided attention. And I think it's important to note there's a difference between listening and hearing.
Yeah.
A good listener helps the speaker, drawing out the story with verbal encouragement and nudges. So if you're you see your patient struggling to find the words to say, pick up the little cues here and there of what they're trying to say, repeat it back to them for verification. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's the difference between a good listener and someone who's maybe just hearing.
Yeah. And also, you know, one of the things that I've learned to do is at work, we have, you know, before I go do a procedure, almost always there's some form that a patient has filled out. I do look at that.
Yeah.
But I don't ever depend on that, because I'll tell you 100% of the time I go in there and I enter. First thing I always say, hi, I'm Christy. I'm going to be doing blah, blah, blah. And then I do, you know, your patient identifier kind of stuff and whatever. But then the next thing I do is say, your doctor sent you here for whatever, whatever. And, you know, talk to me about what kind of problems you're having. Why did your doctor send you here for this test? And then I just let them talk, because I always get so much more information than whatever they wrote on that sheet.
Right.
And a lot of times, whatever they wrote on that sheet doesn't even correlate with what they're saying to me.
Mm-hmm.
And when they finish, I will say to them, is there anything else that you want me to be aware of before we start?
Yeah.
Because a lot of times they'll be like, oh, well, one more thing. And sometimes they go off in a tangent about something completely unrelated. But sometimes they actually, the most critical something information relevant, that I need to know is in that little, you know, footnote. And they also, and then I'll go back to that form and I'll say, well, on the form you wrote down blah, blah, blah. And they'll be like, oh, well, that's just what my doctor was thinking was wrong with me. And it, so it's not even their symptom. It's just what their doctor mentioned to them. So, so it's so important to listen to the patient.
Agreed.
Let them talk.
Agreed. And we'll get into that a little bit more later on. But one thing that I think is interesting that I saw noted in one of the articles I was reading, the word poor historian being documented in patients' medical records.
Mm-hmm.
If you're talking about, you know, physicians need to be good listeners and active listening. Sometimes the word poor historian can just be, a write-off, like, this patient,
Yeah, it's not a problem on the part of the historian. It's a problem on the part of the person taking the history.
Right.
Do patients get to put in their chart, my doctor is a bad listener? Yeah. My doctor is a poor listener?
The only instance when I could see, you know, poor historian being accurate is if you had someone with some sort of cognitive impairment come without a family member or an aide.
Yeah, they either can't understand what's going on with them, or it hasn't been explained, and so they are completely oblivious.
Right.
You know, and if they had lived in the medieval times, they would have fallen into that category.
Yeah. So this one, these next few are something that I think is very important when I consider bedside manner, especially given my experiences.
Mm-hmm.
The doctor has to educate the patients and answer any of their questions.
Mm-hmm.
You have to educate your patient.
Yeah.
The doctor, and that conflicts with what came from the ancient times.
Yeah. And also that does not get done, because... Right. Because I can tell you, like, for example, there are certain procedures that I performed, and the patient comes in, they have absolutely no idea
what they're about to happen.
What was about to happen, or why? Why are we doing this test? Yeah. They have no idea.
They went through the entire scheduling,
right.
Insurance verification, showing up, changing your clothes, everything.
Right. So, like, that tells me that whoever sent them for this procedure did not bother to say, we're going to do this because...
Right.
Blah, blah, blah.
A follow-up to that first one is the doctor must gain an understanding of what the patient knows. So the physician needs to make sure that the patient has an accurate understanding of everything that they just talked about.
Mm-hmm.
Don't let your patient walk out if you just diagnosed them with an autoimmune disease. Let them think, oh my God, I have cancer.
Yeah.
You know, you need to make sure that your patient knows what they're talking about. And also too, if they, not that they would change physicians, but let's say they go to the hospital.
Yeah.
Or the ER or something, they're going to need to accurately tell the physicians... Be good historians.
Right.
And also the doctor should reconcile what the patients know or believe about their condition with the knowledge he has to bring to the patients regarding a balanced understanding of their illness, which again, I think is just reiterating what we said before.
Mm-hmm.
As treatment begins, if you move forward with any kind of aftercare, bedside manner has to be applied. And then also you need to know that every patient is different.
Yeah.
So you need an open and personalized and caring bedside manner.
You need to be able to read a room.
Agreed. You need, and
because this is every hard patient because a needs lot of, something different.
Some of the smartest people in the world are physicians.
Yeah.
And they have no social cues.
Right.
None.
Yeah.
And it's needed.
Yeah.
And I say this to students that I work with all the time. You can be the smartest test taker in the world. You can know that book inside and out. But if you can't talk to a patient,
right.
I'm not going to hire you.
Yeah. 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 I know.
You have to have it.
Yeah.
So I was reading an article from Professor Martin Elliott. He's from Gresham College. He wrote this article in 2018, and he went through a list of items that he believes is a good bedside manner. And I think you, mm-hmm. I think you're going to agree with a lot of these because I do.
Mm-hmm.
I want, and I'm just going to quote him here. I want them to stand up to greet me. Shaking hands will be fine, and introduce themselves. Hello, my name is blank. Staying seated at the desk is not good enough.
Right. I agree.
And I can't remember if it was in this article that I read as well. Dr. Kate Granger experienced this when she was diagnosed with cancer. So she, in 2013, began a national campaign called hashtag Hello, My Name Is.
Aww,
in an effort to get people that. To introduce themselves.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah. He goes on to say, I want eye contact. I want them to look at me and not the computer, preferably not over a desk with me on a lower chair. That's a power play.
Yes.
And I get the computer thing. You have to make notes, but you shouldn't be on that much of a time crunch that you can't look at me while I'm talking and then turn to make notes.
Right. And also when I go in to explain a procedure to a patient, I like to sit on the little rolly stool and like sit face to face, you know, so that like I want them to see that you have my undivided attention and I'm not in a rush.
Yeah.
And let's just talk before we start doing anything.
Yeah.
You know.
He moves on to say, I want them to be clean, which kind of goes into professional appearance. When I think of you want them to be clean, I think of, okay, no dirt under your fingernails.
Right.
Your hair is, you know, clean. You don't want
them to
have,
right. Yeah. You don't want them to have a 5 o'clock shadow or plaque on their teeth or,
right.
You know,
right.
Or look disheveled or wrinkled clothing or whatever. And,
right.
Yeah, it's interesting because I was reading an article about physician appearance and they were talking about that patients really do prefer their doctors to wear a white coat, even though that's that can be associated with higher incidence of
white coat syndrome.
No, not white coat syndrome, but infection. Like It's not good infection control to wear the same white coat, like all throughout the day, you know, but I mean, I don't know how that's different than just the shirt that you have on. But my point is that, you know, even though patients were told, well, you know, you have a higher risk of your doctor, you know, I don't know, you getting an infection from your doctor wearing that white coat. They were like, we don't care. We want the doctor to wear a white coat.
Yeah.
But patients also don't necessarily want their doctors to be in a mink coat either. So, like, you know, they want it to be appropriate, which this day and time usually is like business casual.
Agreed.
With a white coat.
Agreed. See, for me personally, the white coat, I could care less about. But yeah, business casual, I would appreciate.
Yeah.
You know, I don't want you in a t-shirt and your Sunday
what about
jeans.
How do you feel about scrubs?
I'm all for scrubs.
Yeah. No, how do you feel about your doctor
wearing scrubs? I'm all for it. I'm all for them to be wearing scrubs because if I'm comfortable working in scrubs in the medical field, I know that he or she has got to feel more comfortable, especially if you're in a busy clinic, you're walking around, you're doing procedures.
Yeah. I will tell you that
it's hard to be on your feet in dress shoes.
I was just going to say, I will tell you that doctors who dress nice and wear a white coat, kudos to them. They look very nice.
Agreed.
However, and maybe because I'm in the medical field, my first thought goes to, you have to be so uncomfortable in that. I mean, you know, those heels cannot be comfortable to traipse around this hospital in.
Right.
Or, you know, that shirt, how in the world can you, you know, do whatever things that you're doing all day wearing that kind of a shirt or that clunky necklace or whatever. So even though it looks nice, it doesn't seem practical to me.
I do know most physicians that I know that wear scrubs do some sort of, you know, OR procedure.
Yeah.
Rarely will I see a physician that doesn't do procedures or anything in scrubs, but I wouldn't be against it.
Yeah.
Professor Elliott moves on to say, if there are other people there, I want to be introduced to them too and told what their role is.
Yes.
And to be asked my permission for them to be there. So when we work with students, we tell them, you introduce yourself as a student and ask them if it is okay if you proceed with doing their exam.
Mm-hmm.
The patient has every right to say no.
Of course, yeah.
And that's okay. I mean, I love students, and I know that you love students. Yeah. We love working with them. So we would wish that all patients would say yes, but it's understandable. This is their healthcare. This is something that that is happening to them. They have every right to say no. But that's why it's important to ask.
Right.
Because if students are required to be in medical attire, they're going to, how is a patient to know if they're a student or not?
Well, I'll tell you, because I'm a mid-level provider and I'm not an actual physician, I do procedures. The first thing I do when I walk into the room is say, I'll say, hi, I'm Christy. I'm Dr. So-and-so's assistant. I'll be performing your procedure today. Because number one, I want to establish that I'm not a doctor.
Yeah.
Because I do wear a white coat, and many times, even though I introduce myself and I say, you know, I'm Dr. So-and-so's assistant, sometimes, especially in patients, sometimes where English is their second language, maybe they'll just continue to call me doctor. Maybe they don't remember my name or they don't know what else to call me. Sometimes.
Do you correct them is the word
question. I usually do the first time. And then if they continue to do it, almost like out of a nervous tick because we're in a procedure or whatever. I just kind of giggle and let it go. But I usually do correct them at least once.
Yeah.
Because I want to make sure that they didn't misunderstand who I am and what my role is. And also, I've had patients look at me sideways like, oh, you're not a doctor? No, I want a doctor. And that doesn't happen often, but it does happen. And whenever it does, I just say, that is no problem. Dr. So-and-so will be glad to come in here and do this.
Yeah.
And then it's usually followed up with some kind of apology from, I'm sorry, it's just, you know, I don't mean to offend. And I'm always like, You are not offending me. I do not take it personally. Yeah. You have every right to request a physician instead of me. I don't take offense to this.
Right.
You know, you are well within your right to request a physician.
Yeah.
It is no skin off my back. I will do 100 million more of these after you. So, yeah. So yeah. You're not, you know, it is not personal. Yeah. And I don't take it personally.
Yeah.
So
I think this next one, on Professor Elliott's list relates to your experience, at the dentist in reference to the other people in the room that he was talking about on the last one. I want the doctor to treat those people with respect and dignity as well.
Yes.
Good behavior is catching.
Yes.
And I agree. I've never experienced that myself, but if I saw a physician
mm-hmm.
being rude to his assistant, his nurse, whatever, that would irk me.
If a doctor is nice to me, but they're completely rude and bullying their staff, that's the same as being rude to me, I think. Like, right. it causes me so much anxiety to yeah. see people being rude to other people. It just,
yeah.
Yeah.
Agreed. Agreed.
Makes me twitch.
Next on the list, he says, I want them to have read my notes, know my history, and have access to any results I need. I want them to demonstrate confidence and competence, but not arrogance or superiority.
Yeah.
I want them to know their stuff.
Yeah.
You obviously want someone who's smart, but you don't want someone to be all cocky about it.
Right. Yeah.
I want them to give me time to present my case, and I want to feel that they have time for me, which is true. It kind of goes back into that. I don't know if you do this, but whenever I go to the doctor, I kind of practice in my head what I'm going to say. Because sometimes it's not just one problem that I have.
Right.
And I need to say, it may be related to my history of this or what have you. And
right.
And I want them to come in and say, give me the opportunity to say what I have to say. Exactly what he said. Present my case.
Yeah.
I want them to listen and be attentive, not to draw conclusions too soon, which I would agree with. Mm-hmm. Before a diagnosis came, I would appreciate any sort of testing that could come, be it imaging or lab work or what have you.
Mm-hmm.
I want them to be warm, compassionate, understanding, and thorough. And a good sense of humor helps.
Yes. Oh, 100%. Yes.
100%. But the whole thing about being warm and compassionate, it's not that hard to do. In reference to the story that I told earlier, all he had to do was say,
right,
we'll figure it out.
Yeah. He didn't need to give you a hug.
Right.
You're like, I'm not even asking you to give me a hug. I'm just asking you to be like, act human for a moment.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what gets us into empathy. Empathy, at its simplest, is awareness of the feelings and emotions of other people. It's a key element in emotional intelligence. It is how we as individuals understand what others are feeling as if we are feeling it ourselves. It is much more than sympathy, which implies feeling for someone, whereas empathy implies feeling with someone.
Yeah. And also, how old was this doctor? Ish.
Less than 50, more than 35.
Okay. So less than 50, older than 35 implies to me that he himself has been a patient at some point in his life on some level.
Yeah.
So even if he's just going for a checkup or whatever, you know, just whatever guys do for their, you know, whatever. he's likely been a patient.
Yeah.
So how would he like to be treated?
Right.
I mean, how would he like to be told, pull your pants down and bend over
and
the...
And that's the other thing, too. You know,
bend over the table, and they're going to come in and, you know, give you a prostate exam.
You and I had this conversation, I believe, on our last episode about, do you prefer a male or a female provider?
Yeah.
And I generally didn't have a preference, but whenever you think about it, for this particular problem that I was having, it was very much a female issue.
Yeah.
And he probably didn't understand what I was going through for 4 years.
Yeah.
And
how he should have dealt with you more sensitively.
Correct. Yeah. And that's when it goes back to empathy.
Yeah.
I don't expect you to understand what I'm saying. Just sit here with me for a second and understand. And there's actually a quote that I want to read. Talking about a patient's desire to have a good bedside manner. I see no reason for my doctor to love me, nor would I expect him to suffer with me. I wouldn't demand a lot of my doctor's time. I just wish he would brood on my situation for perhaps 5 minutes, that he would give me his whole mind and just once be bonded with me for a brief space, survey my soul as well as my flesh to get at my illness, for each man is ill in his own way.
Yeah. Yeah, like just be present with me. Just take the moment in.
Right.
And treat me as a whole individual and not just this person with this diagnosis.
I have never bawled in front of a physician before.
Yeah.
And when I tell you that I was like dry heaving, crying.
Yeah.
For a response like that was completely inappropriate.
And then how did you feel about having that moment of vulnerability wasted on that kind of person?
Right.
Did it make you mad?
It made me very mad.
Yeah.
Because I'm not that kind of person. That's what I'm saying. I've never done that before. And for it to have...
That's what I'm thinking, is that if I were you, I would be like, I am so mad that you saw that raw side of me and you didn't deserve it. You didn't earn it and you didn't deserve it.
And I have a physician that I'm very close with. He's my GI doctor. He's the one that manages my Crohn's. He gets me.
Yeah.
And I almost feel like I would have much rather shared that experience with him.
Yes.
Because I know I would have gotten so much more out of it.
Right.
And yes, exactly what you say. It makes me angry that he got to see that
that
side of me.
Yeah.
And now, I'm under the assumption that his perception of me is, this whiny little girl over here.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like.
Yeah. I feel like I want you to write him a letter and just go. You could even do it anonymously. You could just write him a letter, a card.
Yeah,
like a blank note card, and just say, I just want you to know the effect that of how you responded to me in this moment. And you could just be very evasive and just go, I just want you to know how you made me feel.
Yeah.
You know, and you don't even have to say, and I hope you feel like shit about it. You could just say, I just want you to know how you made me feel.
Yeah.
Because like, you know, like you think of, I mean, he deals with, you're not the only patient that he's seen with this, right?
Right.
So, I mean, I know you're not. So it's like, you just, that just makes me so mad.
Yeah.
For you.
So going back to empathy, how we were talking earlier about how, can you even teach empathy? Is it even worth having a class? Because I remember when I first started in my medical trade in patient care was the first class you take. And I think it is, despite what field you're going into in medicine, that's going to be your first class. And empathy is always taught. I used to
teach patient care and I loved it. It was my favorite class to teach. Yes.
Oh, it would be my favorite too, I think. Yeah. Because it gives you the chance to see possibility, like the, what's the word I'm looking for? Like
the potential.
Potential that they have to be really good.
This is the way I look at it. You have the capability, you have the ability to make a difference in someone's life. You can make a difference for the better or for the worse.
Yeah.
Even if you're not doing anything, you know, super heroic in their medical appointment. But the point is like, you can take any encounter with a patient, no matter what it is, and make it special for them in a positive way.
Yeah.
And I think that's the part of my job that I love, is that feeling like any, you know, you could line up 100 people that could do this procedure the same or better than I could. Right. But I really, like, it matters to me that I make you feel comfortable that, you know, and that I just made a difference. Yeah. Like, I just feel like, you know, that's probably the most important thing about my job that I like.
Agreed.
How does everyone in healthcare not feel like that? I don't understand.
I know. Well, that's what intrigued me about the, I forget who it was that you said doctors should not want for wealth. Like wealth is not, shouldn't be a thing. And in my head, Galen. When I'm thinking about a physician or someone in the healthcare field
yeah.
that does not have empathy
yeah.
is only in it for the money.
Yeah. Yeah.
But again, with empathy, like there's no way to really teach it. It's just an innate, yeah. there's no way to measure for it either. So yeah. if you're trying right. to weed out people in a class, there's no way to yeah. tell. Professor Elliott mentioned a study that said that empathy decreases most in men and specifically men who are entering non-core specialties. Women who entered core disciplines maintained their empathy, but if they went into non-core specialties like surgery, pathology, or radiology, they did not. So they started to lose their empathy, which if you think about something like surgery or pathology where you're in a lab,
removed.
Your patients are under anesthesia, yeah. radiologist, you're in a room looking at a computer all day.
Yeah.
You don't have that.
Yeah.
That interaction.
Yeah.
It has been suggested that students are attracted to role models who are authoritative, skilled, and effective. And he mentions that Dr. House is a good example. He has good investigative skill, but he has grumpy bedside manner.
Mm-hmm.
But students are more likely to look up to him because he's very, very smart.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if you ever watched the show House.
I haven't.
After doing all this research, he's grumpy. He's not nice to his patients. If anything, he goes out of his way to be rude to them, mm-hmm. but you still enjoy watching the show. First of all, you know it's fake, but you also know that he's going to do his damnedest
right.
to find out what's wrong with
right.
him.
Right. Because he's a fierce advocate of his patients.
Right.
So let me ask you this. Can I ask you this right now? What would you rather? Would you rather have a grumpy doctor, would you rather have somebody that's just a total asshole, but is,
no.
Yeah.
Me like either. Like the best in their field?
Me either. I just wouldn't. I can tell you, yeah, because like, and I, you know, it feels like you should say, like I should be saying, oh, would you rather have an asshole who's the best, or would you rather have somebody that's not that good but is so nice? But it's not even that. It's like, I just want you to have both. I want you to be competent and appropriate. I want you to be appropriate. So right. you don't have to be the best.
Right.
But as long as you can do it without messing me up,
right.
you know, that's good enough. That's good enough for right. me. But if you have a good bedside manner, I will choose you over the very best. Like, I don't care about.
I agree. Because someone with good bedside manner, if your illness or your issue is outside of their scope of practice, they're going to tell you,
right.
you know what?
Yeah.
I'm going to refer you to a specialist.
Yeah. Yeah.
So.
Cry uncle. They know when to cry uncle.
But someone like that will tell you that, as opposed to the cocky, arrogant
yeah.
one.
Who, narcissist.
Who's a narcissist. Yeah. yeah who's just going to, you're going to sit there and take it, even yeah. though they may be thinking, I should really send this person somewhere
right.
else.
Yeah.
So I think, Christy, you had mentioned earlier about, you know, with the advanced technology practices, essential bedside manners are starting to disappear.
Mm-hmm.
With all of these advanced technologies, doctors work in different ways now and often spend less time with the patient. Most provider visits, office visits, are scheduled in 10 or 15 minute time slots.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think 10 or 15 minutes is enough? Because let me tell you something. Bobby Sue, the 74-year-old lady that's got knee pain, is not coming in here to talk to you about knee pain. She's
right.
going to talk to you about her high blood pressure, her neighbor's dog.
Yeah.
You know.
I think it's ridiculous that, you know, whatever has created this situation where you literally have like a 10-minute appointment with your doctor. I think
yeah.
whatever has created that, and we could get into our, you know, the things that contributed to that, but I don't want to do that.
I did. Yes, I did. A lot of this stuff about the appointment times and all that got very political.
Yes. Bit. And so we are not here to debate any of that. But I do think that, like, it has to, I mean, you just have to sit and wonder, like, how can anybody think this is good medicine?
And
the
then,
people making these decisions.
If you're coming from the mind frame of a patient,
yeah,
we are going to sit here and say 10 minutes is not long enough. You right. need to make the appointments longer.
Right.
Well, guess what? Then that's going to mean they're not going to be able to see as many patients in a day.
Yeah.
Then that means that they're going to have a longer wait time to get in. For instance, specialties.
Yeah.
They have longer appointments, 30, 45 minutes. And it takes sometimes a month to get in to see a specialist.
Yeah.
Because of that time frame.
Yeah.
And I think ERs now are also overflowing because patients can't get in to see something when it's like, you know, I need antibiotics now or something. Even if it's something simple like strep, you're going to the ER because you can't get in to see your doctor.
Yeah.
And then too, like with also with the short time frames and the advance in technology, patients have access to the internet now. So they're better informed and guaranteed they're Googling all their symptoms.
Oh, yeah.
And they're going to want to talk about that during their visit.
Mm-hmm.
Professor Elliott also mentions in his article from 2018, on average, patients are usually allowed to speak for only 22 seconds before the doctor interrupts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
22 seconds.
I read an article that said 14 seconds. Or maybe it's the TED Talk that I'm going to talk about in a few minutes. Yeah, where he said it's like 14 seconds.
You know, and if you're encouraged, kind of like you said, you ask the open-ended questions.
Yeah.
Don't say, oh, are you here for your knee?
Yeah.
Because then what if something is really bothering them?
Yeah.
Or doesn't give them the chance to talk about it. But I do know physicians that if you do come and say, I want to talk about my right knee, that's what you made the appointment for, and you show up, you say, oh, I also need my medication.
Sorry, you need to make a separate appointment.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And they talk about because of billing or coding or time frames or whatever. Yeah.
I remember the first time that happened to me was probably like 20 years ago, and I could not believe it. I was like, are you kidding me right now? Are you kidding me right now?
Yeah. And mine, the one time it happened to me, it was just for a medication refill.
Uh-huh.
And all she had to do was ask me in that appointment,
yeah,
is it working for you?
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, to be fair, I get it and I don't get it.
Yeah.
Like, I get it, but I don't like it. Because in that instance, too, if you sit there and you let that patient talk, you're going to run 45 minutes behind, and then you're going to have an entire lobby full, and then every patient
although now there's all this the messaging that you can do with your doctors. I love that, because in California where I lived, like, my doctor, I could send her an email and she almost always responded the same day. If she didn't respond, somebody from her staff almost always did the same day. It was so nice, because prescription refills and all that kind of stuff, that could just be done electronically.
Right.
Didn't even have to go and talk to her, you know, for the most part.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love being able to message
my
providers.
Yeah.
I love that. I wonder if they love it. I bet they don't. Because just imagine, okay, let's think about it from the physician standpoint. If you're the physician and you're having 110-minute appointments every day with some patients that have very complex problems, okay?
Right.
I realize not every appointment is 10 minutes. But anyway, okay, I'm being a little bit dramatic. But, and then you also have, you know, your patients just sending you a message whenever they want.
I do think a lot of the times the nurses filter through those messages.
Yeah, that's true. Hopefully.
Because sometimes I have nurses answer me.
Yeah. Yeah, me too.
Sometimes the physician will answer me. And I do think I could see their frustration maybe sometimes if a patient wants to send a message in lieu of making an appointment for something that they need to make an appointment for.
Yeah.
Which I have seen in charts where the patient will try to do that. And the response is, please make an appointment to be seen in clinic.
Yeah.
But I agree with you. As a patient, it is so easy. It is so easy to just ask a question.
Yeah. Yeah.
We had mentioned, did we mention the placebo effect, placebo medicine earlier? Did
we? No, we have not talked about that.
I'm going to read a little piece of an article here that says a doctor should always aim to stimulate self-healing, known as placebo medicine, to enhance a patient's potential for healing. In Latin, the word placebo means I shall please. Placebo effect is the process of a doctor using self-healing methods to heal a patient. The attitudes of the patient and the doctor, as well as their faith in each other and the processes, are very important in producing therapeutic results.
Mm-hmm.
So kind of like that lady who doesn't know she has cancer,
right,
is living happy and she, her health has started to get better.
Right. Yeah.
They, yeah. You know, you hear the phrase, oh, speak it into existence,
yes,
all the time. And it's just that feeling of staying positive,
yeah,
and believing that,
yeah,
it's going to work.
Yeah. And if you have a doctor that's treating you and he does not have a good bedside manner, he has not developed or established a rapport with you, you don't have confidence and faith in him, the placebo effect will not work.
Yeah, absolutely not.
You have to have, that's the thing about the placebo effect.
Yeah.
Is that you have to have that established trust and mutual respect and, you know, all of the things that go into having a good patient-doctor relationship.
Yeah.
So,
you know, it wasn't until I was diagnosed with Crohn's that I really realized the toll that stress takes on your body.
Mm-hmm.
Just anxiety about something.
Yes.
Worrying about something.
Yes.
How much it genuinely takes a toll on your body.
Yes.
So someone who's, you know, if we were talking like cancer level illness, who's constantly worried or worried, yes, about the doctor, I mean,
yeah,
it's going to take a toll on your health.
Right.
Even, yeah, if it's not directly related to the problem you're having.
Yeah.
The rest of you is going to just fall apart.
Yeah. So one thing I want to recommend to our listeners, Mindy, is I watched this TED Talk by Dr. Abraham Verghese. He is a physician. He's currently practicing. And the name of his TED Talk is A Doctor's Touch. And in this TED Talk, he discusses a cautionary tale, or he tells a cautionary tale of the importance of touching patients. I mean, like in the spirit of physical exam. So he also discusses the importance of conversing with the patient. And, oh, he introduces this term that he coined, the eye patient, because so much time is now spent reviewing patients' electronic medical record as opposed to being at the patient's bedside. So he was like saying when he was a medical student or whatever, and he was doing, you know, daily rounds, yeah, or whatever, they would do it at the patient's bedside. Now that stuff takes place in a conference room around a table and everybody's looking at the patient's electronic medical record and they're discussing all of this stuff with the patient about the patient, you know, in the absence of the patient.
Yeah.
Which I thought was interesting.
Yeah.
But it's a very, very interesting TED Talk about, it really is about bedside manner. It's sort of disguised in the way that he talks about the importance of like physical examination of your patient. But the overall message is, you know, a physician's bedside manner. So, all right. Well, thank you, Mindy, for...
Thanks for having me again.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for being here. And thank you everyone for listening. And we hope you will join us again next week.
Bye, everybody.